5. Latin America's slide to the left. Latin America's slide leftward since the implosion of the Soviet Union sparked the attention of Russia, China, and Iran. Through a series of political and economic arrangements, Latin America was drawn into the Kremlin-led global strategic quadrangle in opposition to the capitalist West, the United States in particular. Russia became a major arms supplier in the region. China established a presence in Panama and is a major purchaser of the region's commodities. Additionally, Iran has expressed solidarity with the leftist regimes and may one day become a supplier and source of expertise for Brazil's once dormant nuclear power and missile capabilities, and also a partner with Venezuela on various trade and military projects. In a very brief period, the Gramsci formula was used to penetrate Latin American politics, and with a success far beyond the Soviet KGB's modest gains during the Cold War. 1. But the shift in Latin America's orientation did not just happen. Two people were primarily responsible, Cuba's Fidel Castro and Brazil's Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Forum of São Paulo. In July 1990, Lula da Silva, then leader of Brazil's Marxist Workers' Party, with the encouragement of Fidel Castro and the Cuban Communist Party, created the São Paulo Forum. From the beginning, the forum was about building socialism and restructuring U.S. influence in Latin America. Cuba's Fidel Castro, following the implosion of the Soviet Union and the death of Marxism-Leninism, joined Lula in his Marxist Renewal and Reemergence program. The Forum of São Paulo had more than 100 members of the Latin American left in the mid-1990s and held regular meetings. The first 5 sessions of the forum were hosted by Brazil's Workers' Party, the Revolutionary Democratic Party of Mexico, the Sandinista Front in Nicaragua, the Cuban Communist Party, and Uruguay's left-wing Broad Front. The leftist participants at the forum's meetings sought to find viable alternatives to the neoliberal ideology, a euphemism for free trade, that was said by the left to have weakened many government social services and created massive unemployment throughout Latin America. Delegates from Maoist, Trotskyist, Marxist-Leninist, Marxist, and Social Democrat parties, as well as several terrorist and guerrilla organizations, attended the 1995 meeting of the São Paulo Forum in Montevideo. The forum organizers proposed a model with real economic, social, and participatory democracy which included everybody in national and regional production and where the state had a role in guaranteeing social welfare, just distribution, and economic regulation. Two, this was not a prescribed strategy for Latin America, but a batch of leftist alternatives for improving social development, achieving social justice, stability, and peace. The forum's 9th meeting was held in Managua, Nicaragua, in February 2000, where the debate over the alternative to neoliberalism continued. During this session, the forum members recognized that, through democracy, the voters and their representatives will be able to ward off the pressures of the great powers, neutralize the damaging actions of the transnational corporations, counteract the power of traditional ruling elites, and advance towards sustainable economic and social development, and justice and equality. The 10th meeting of the São Paulo Forum was held in Havana in December 2001. Participants numbered 518 delegates from 81 countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, Europe, Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Australia. 74 member parties and political movements were represented, plus 127 invited parties and organizations. Among the attendees were several active terrorist organizations, including the FARC and ELN from Colombia, Tupac Amaru from Peru, MIR of Chile, the Basque ETA from Spain, and others. The main axes of the alternatives discussed emphasized the priority of social objectives in the recovery of development and sovereignty, impulses to regional integration as a form of insertion into the world economy, the construction of authentic participatory democracies by taking into account the increasing role of women and young people, the ongoing profound struggle of the indigenous peoples, and the fight against every form of exploitation, economic oppression, and alienation of the rights of citizens. The final declaration closed with, "Our struggle is for political, economic, and social transformation. It is a battle of ideas for a better world." 5. Absent was the Marxist-Leninist rhetoric of the past about class struggle, violent clashes with capitalism, and world revolution. The 21st century battle for ideas was about transformation, and participatory democracy leftists speak for engaging the self-disenfranchised poor and outing the ruling elite through the ballot box. This is Antonio Gramsci's formula for passive revolution. The ideological die had been cast for Latin America's transformation into socialist states while working in concert with each other against economic globalization through an idealized regional entity, the South America Community of Nations. When Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva ran for Brazil's presidency with the strong backing of the Marxist Workers' Party, PT, Partido de los Trabajadores, and much of the peasantry, he played down his role as a radical workers' leader and supporter of land reform. Immediately upon being elected to the presidency in 2003, Lula began casting new images on the wall of Plato's cave, presenting his orthodox economic politics to northern financial circles. Lula is a free trader, gushed bankers in North America. Brazil's huge foreign debt would be serviced, but nationalization of major industries and land reform were not on Lula's expressed agenda. Lula's foreign policy advisor, a hardline Marxist, Marco Aurelio Garcia, spilled the beans when he commented on Lula's effort to fool the world about the true nature of Brazil's Marxist regime. "We have to first give the impression that we are democratic. Initially, we have to accept certain things. But that won't last." This is a perfect example of Antonio Gramsci's formula for gaining power through the ballot box, consolidating control while implanting Marxism in the inner man, and finally moving to a socialist, workers' paradise. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez joined Fidel Castro and Lula da Silva in their joint leadership of the Sao Paulo Forum by virtue of his huge oil wealth and a mouth to match in excoriating the United States. When Castro's secret intelligence services helped engineer Chavez's return to power after a short-lived coup in 2002, Chavez returned the favor by giving Cuba billions of dollars in free and heavily subsidized oil. Moreover, Castro became a revolutionary mentor to the brash chieftain from Caracas. Chavez appeared to have seized the inside track on becoming Latin America's next Fidel. In the absence of Castro, it would fall to Lula to keep Chavez on the Gramscian track and save him from his penchant to overplay his cards. These big three each brought something special to the revolutionary table in Latin America. Fidel Castro contributed decades of experience in neutralizing the hostility of a succession of U.S. presidents. Moreover, Castro's image as a guiding light of Marxism looms bright across Latin America. In addition, thanks to Soviet assistance during the Cold War, Castro had trained more than 10,000 intelligence agents whose networks extend across the world and even into the most secret warrens of the U.S. government. Lula da Silva brought long experience in leading a Marxist workers' union in Brazil, and for years he maintained undercover close relations with communists and revolutionaries throughout Latin America. Brazil's previous nuclear and ballistic missile technology programs could provide a credible starting point for development of weapons of mass destruction, especially if Hugo Chavez funded such an effort. This is more than a theoretical what-if possibility. In a letter to President George W. Bush from 13 members of Congress in October 2002, the representatives expressed their concern with Lula da Silva's remarks concerning adherence to the Treaty on Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. Lula is quoted in the letter as having said that compliance with the NPT would make sense only if all countries that already have clear weapons all gave them up. He continued, "If someone asks me to disarm and keep a slingshot and he comes at me with a cannon, what good does that do?" And concluding, "All of us developing countries are left holding a slingshot while they have atomic bombs." Hugo Chavez walked a carefully scripted line in a slow-rolling passive revolution by first winning election through the democratic process, consolidating his presidency with active Cuban support, defunding the military and police, neutralizing opposition forces, assuring his electoral base through land redistribution, obtaining expanded political powers for a national assembly he controlled, silencing the independent news media, rewriting selected portions of the nation's constitution, beginning the nationalization of strategic economic entities, and setting new profit-sharing rules for foreign corporations. He built, with the aid and counsel of Fidel Castro and Lula da Silva, a Latin American version of the Gramsci blueprint of passive revolution for export to neighboring countries. The Gramsci blueprint used by Fidel Castro, Lula da Silva, and Hugo Chavez and development of the Venezuelan socialist model exerts a continued influence on at least five other Latin American countries impelling their respective slide to the left. Some appear to be following the Gramsci-Chavez populism script for the Bolivarian Revolution, while others seem to pick and choose in their choice of political salsa for developing their new socialist orientation. Social inequality is Latin America's central problem, a reality that has not been lost on Fidel Castro, Lula da Silva, or Hugo Chavez. Like the Three Musketeers, this socialist trio wields the sword of radical populism, or Gramsci Marxism, throughout Latin America. They provide the frustrated masses' charismatic leadership, messianic impulses, revolutionary socialism, and the increasing ability, thanks to Venezuela's prodigious oil resources and rising prices, to provide grants to the poor. Their Gramscian program is based on reducing social inequalities through income supplements and government promises of more to come as a tool for garnering votes. In a word, democracy is being used to secure power for socialist governance under the guidance of charismatic leaders, who, in time, will destroy their own liberal democracies. Constitutional reform in Venezuela, for instance, is not about simply rewriting principles to govern society. Rather, the new constitution embodied Hugo Chavez's philosophy for revolutionary change and a new strategic vision of the role of the state in people's lives, anti-imperialism, the United States, and a shift in Latin America's geopolitical balance of power. Cuba. Fidel Castro laid out a severe indictment against capitalism in an address at the Group of 77 meeting in September 1999. Castro's themes would be repeated over and over by Western progressive socialist Marxists in the subsequent anti-globalization protests in North America and Europe. The world is still very far from materializing the potential of globalization. It develops today under the aegis of neoliberal policies that impose unregulated markets and unbridled privatization. Far from promoting the expansion of development throughout an increasingly interdependent world badly in need of sharing the progresses achieved, neoliberal globalization has aggravated existing inequalities and raised to inordinate heights social inequities and the most disturbing contrasts between extreme wealth and extreme poverty. Less than 3 months following the 1999 G77 session, more than 50,000 anti-globalization protesters poured into the streets of Seattle and shut down meetings of the World Trade Organization meetings. Peter Boyle of the Australian Socialist Party put it succinctly, "This movement is fundamentally against capitalism. Ideologically, it is a ragtag army whose leading detachments include communists, anarchists, feminists, environmentalists, anti-racists, neo-hippies, and alternate lifestylists." Boyle added that these currents are united in opposition to corporate tyranny. 4 months after the battle for Seattle, Castro honed the corporate tyranny and other key anti-globalization themes in an address at the opening session of the South Summit. Globalization has been held tight by the patterns of neoliberalism, thus it is not development that goes global but poverty. It is not respect for the national sovereignty of our states but the violation of that respect. It is not solidarity amongst our peoples but suavecapitee in the unequal competition prevailing in the marketplace, Castro told his audience. At this summit of the third world countries, we would have to say, we either unite and establish close cooperation, or we die. With the anti-globalization movement underway and socialism strengthened at home, Castro celebrated his 75th birthday with his Marxist protege Hugo Chavez in August 2001. A key aspect of Chavez's social revolution in Venezuela was close collaboration with his mentor, Fidel Castro. One must strongly suspect that Chavez learned the ABCs of the Gramscian blueprint from Castro as well as at the meetings of the Forum of Sao Paulo during the 1990s. 14. More than 3,000 Cuban trainers and 450 medical personnel were sent to Venezuela to assist Chavez in consolidating his control and garnering support among the country's most needy. The Cuba-Venezuela links were also strengthened at the mid-level through the exchange of governors and civil society politicians, youth delegates, and trade unionists. The latter are especially important in the Gramsci formula for consolidating support among the people. Castro was helping Chavez build the foundation necessary for a transition to a totalitarian communist state, albeit one based on Antonio Gramsci's cultural Marxism. In 2001, the Venezuela-Cuban relationship was just the beginning. By the end of 2005, Cuba had dispatched 30,000 doctors, dentists, teachers, and sports trainers to Venezuela to work mainly in the pro-Chavez slums of Caracas. Such measures are essential in the Gramsci blueprint to consolidate support among the people in preparation for the neutering the coercive authority of the police and military. Also in 2005, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez invited hundreds of Cuban intelligence agents to Caracas, where they took up positions in key security positions throughout the government. Cubans have been noted in the main Civilian Intelligence and Preventive Investigations Agency, Military Intelligence, the Central Bank, Interior Ministry, and Immigration Department. Cubans also moved into key administrative positions in all states of Venezuela, and Cubans dominated Chavez's security entourage. Meanwhile, Venezuela was providing money for Gramscian opposition voices in several Latin American countries with the aim of enabling Marxist regimes to emerge across the continent. Cuba-trained personnel and Venezuelan oil resources coalesced in pushing Latin American countries to the left. The key ingredient in making this possible was the implementation of Gramsci's cultural Marxism, a blueprint that is producing significant results against tepid opposition. During a visit of a Chinese military delegation in July 2001, Raul Castro took the opportunity to reiterate Cuba's full support to Beijing's efforts to achieve national unity by incorporating Taiwan. Members of the Chinese delegation said that their visit was a part of continuing efforts to strengthen the ties of friendship and cooperation between the two peoples and their armed forces. In April 2005, China increased its military sales to Cuba, although Castro said it did not include weapons. Nevertheless, U.S. intelligence agencies had detected shipments of arms to Cuba in 2000, including dual-use, civilian-military explosives. Fidel Castro visited Iran, the third hub in the strategic quadrangle, in May 2001. He praised Tehran for its struggle against imperialism. "My visit to Iran for me and my nation is a great privilege," Castro said on Iran's state-run television. "I truly believe the relations of the two countries will be stronger after this trip." At Tehran University, Castro told his audience that Iran and Cuba, in cooperation with each other, can bring America to its knees. "The U.S. regime is very weak, and we are witnessing this weakness from close up." By 2003, Tehran and Havana joined forces, with Cuba jamming U.S. satellite broadcasts to Iran. The Telestar, 12 commercial communications satellite orbits at 15 degrees west, 22,000 miles above the Atlantic. The satellite was positioned too far from Iran to jam it effectively, but it was within range of Cuba. With Havana's help, TV news broadcast by the Voice of America in the Persian language never reached their intended audience. Brazil. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was swept into the presidency on January 1, 2003, with 62% of the vote. A Marxist, Lula tapped into the public frustrations over the government's inability to deliver prosperity after a decade of free market reforms and a public debt mounting to a whopping $260 billion. Throughout his campaign, Lula portrayed the United States as the main enemy, and he remained steadfast in his opposition to the proposed free trade area of the Americas Agreement. He also promised to use Brazil's high-tech industry to boost the economy by producing and selling nuclear weapons. Lula da Silva created and convened annual meetings of the Forum of Sao Paulo in 1990. These early conferences were attended by all of the communist and radical left parties in Latin America, as well as the region's terrorist organizations, Irish Republican Army, Spain's ETA Terrorists, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, and representatives of state sponsors of terrorism, Iraq, Libya, Cuba, and others. The Sao Paulo Forum meetings served as the successor to Fidel Castro's Tricontinental Congress established in 1966 to help terrorist groups better coordinate their attacks against the United States and its allies. From this modest beginning, the forum grew into a major coordinator for an increasing number of international members. The forum also served as a major source of disinformation against the West. Working papers from the forum's December 2002 meeting, for example, claimed that NATO troops perpetrated genocide in Kosovo, U.S. and British forces massacred the population in Afghanistan, and Israel continues to carry out a systematic policy of murdering Palestinians. From the first day of his presidency, Lula made it clear that he would operate in partnership with his ideological allies, Fidel Castro in Cuba and President Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. On his first day in office, Lula had breakfast with Chavez and dinner with Castro. Given Lula's close relationship with Castro and bringing radical leftists and terrorists together at the Forum of Sao Paulo's meetings and his hard-nosed leadership of Brazil's Leftist Workers' Party, it is not a surprise that he embraced Castro and his protege, Hugo Chavez. Moreover, given Lula's position on North America's alleged exploitation of Latin America, he certainly was a partner in Castro's guidance of the anti-globalization campaign against neoliberalism in the United States in particular. The Forum of Sao Paulo, including all of its communist and radical left members, appears to have been the board of directors for the anti-globalization campaign against the International Monetary Fund, World Bank, World Trade Organization, and other international financial institutions and free trade fora. In spite of his rhetoric and anti-US activities in the shadows, Lula has had a long-running campaign trying to convince officials in the lending agencies in the U.S. foreign policy community that he is a politician they can deal with. The Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Policy Studies, a radical left think tank with many connections among the so-called progressives in the U.S. government and the Congress, helped Lula make his case. President Lula da Silva's support in the Workers' Party, according to the Malden Institute, was drawn from the radical Roman Catholic Church liberation theology adherents in the church's labor pastorate, leftist and Castroite students and intellectuals, Trotskyist communist factions and radical peasant organizations, including the militant Movimento dos Sem Terra, MST, Movement of Landless Rural Workers. The MST is a founder of the People's Global Action, PGA, Anti-Globalization Direct Action Network. Lula's pragmatism in implementing Gramsci's revisionist Marxist model created a cross-current of perceptions in the industrialized North. While he gagged on the necessity of free trade to service and reduce Brazil's huge foreign debt, he also met regularly through the Sao Paulo Forum with revolutionary leftists such as the Cuban Communist Party, Brazil's Marxist Workers' Party, Nicaraguan Sandinistas, El Salvador's Communist FMLN, terrorists of the Irish Republican Army, Basque ETA, Colombia's FARC, and some of the most blood-drenched terrorists in the Middle East. In a word, President Lula da Silva is a Marxist with the goal of eliminating U.S. power and influence in Latin America, but only when the time is right. He remained a disgruntled free trader out of necessity, even when he hugged President George W. Bush during his visit to Brazil in March 2007. The open question is what might be his policy course when he deems the time to be right. Lula's strategy is to deal with the United States while he assists South American countries in their slide to the left and to promote a new unity through the South American Community of Nations, an envisioned continent-wide community similar to the European Union. 12 countries have signed an agreement to create the new trading bloc representing 361 million people with a gross domestic product of $973 billion, exporting $181 billion of goods and services. The Community of Nations provides a means of maintaining good relations with the U.S., while building a continental unity of socialist states and exploring economic and political connections with emerging powers such as China and Iran. When President Lula da Silva was elected to the presidency, he found his troubled country with long-standing problems that defied quick fixes. Organized crime had plundered the nation for years, and assassins had been hired by merchants to eliminate the very poor and street people. An analysis conducted by the MST revealed in 2004 that the government under Lula had settled less than 30,000 rural families as compared to 115,000 families called for by the National Agrarian Reform Plan. As a consequence, the MST promised landless peasant invasions of land and buildings as well as public demonstrations to call attention to the need for agrarian reform. President Lula da Silva's Bolsa Família cash assistance program, amounting to more than $11 million, paid $40 per month to poor families so long as their children attended school regularly and had regular health checkups and vaccinations. Many believe the Bolsa Família program to be one of the most successful social programs in Brazil, and it was the key to Lula's landslide re-election in October 2006, 60%. But right from the beginning of his first term, Lula faced a dilemma. While his foremost desire was to transform Brazil into a fair trade, socialist state, the country's large government debt, underwritten mostly by U.S. banks and contracts, led him to dance with the capitalist devil en route to reaching his Marxist revolutionary goals. To calm his nervous creditors in the North, Lula promised to service the debt and to fulfill existing free trade contracts, while acknowledging that the Brazilian people voted for another economic model, socialism. Lula held his nose and towed the line in accommodating free trade talks with President George W. Bush and U.S. trade officials in March 2007, pledging to use his second term in office, which began on January 1, 2007, to craft policies that would produce 5% growth annually. President Lula da Silva faced an enormous economic task. Brazil was being torn down by a huge debt with a benchmark interest rate of 13.25%. down from a high of 19.75%. These are the highest interest rates in the world and promise to keep Brazil in a condition of perennial economic depression. President Lula da Silva successfully put off the day for the inevitable confrontation with the United States. First, at the outset of his first term, Lula had to find a way to smooth ruffled feathers among his followers for taking a tactical free trade path. The opportunity to achieve this came in January 2003. When Lula used the podium at the World Economic Forum at Davos, Switzerland, to make a case for helping the world's poor. The Davos meeting was attended by hundreds of the world's top financial shakers and movers and important political leaders from around the globe. Lula called for northern governments and big investors to create a global fund to fight poverty and hunger around worldwide. Lula, the son of a poor farmer, said that countries are spending billions and billions of dollars in an arms race and spending money on things that are not priorities. At the same time, he said, we look at the third world countries and millions of women and children die because they don't manage to eat the calories they need. Lula is not without potential leverage in dealing with the North and its creditors. He has openly declared that Brazil should restart its nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. President da Silva is adamant that its nuclear facility at Resend, not far from Rio de Janeiro, will be used to produce low-enriched uranium for use in power plants, not highly enriched material for use in nuclear weapons. In addition, Brazil has one of the largest uranium deposits in the world. If it masters the complete fuel cycle, it could sell low-enriched uranium to others, netting Brazil billions of dollars annually. One problem with this scenario is that Brazil has a long record of restricting the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, inspections. During past IAEA inspections, critical machinery was covered to prevent disclosure of Brazil's technological breakthroughs. The IAEA insists that full disclosure of all equipment is necessary to ensure uranium is not being enriched to a level where they could be used in the development of nuclear weapons. In addition, the IAEA wants to know the sources of Brazil's equipment. According to reports in 1975, Brazil transferred technology from its power plants to a nuclear weapons program. Brazil is China's largest trading partner in Latin America, while China is Brazil's third largest trading partner after the United States and Argentina. In a visit to China in early 2004, President Lula da Silva told his hosts that Brazil and China share the vision of an international order that is more just and equitable, based on multipolarity and on respect for international law. China's leader Hu Jintao replied that he believed Lula's visit would push forward the strategic partnership between China and Brazil. Several agreements were signed during the visit to promote greater cooperation between the two countries. During a two-week tour of Argentina, Chile, Cuba, and Brazil, Chinese President Hu Jintao told the Brazilian National Assembly that China was determined to force unprecedented ties with Latin American and Caribbean countries. Brazil proclaimed China as a strategic partner. About 10 million Arabs live in Brazil, the largest Arab population outside the Middle East. Some 25,000 of the country's Muslim population live in the southwestern city of Foz do Iguaçu, which is Brazil's portion of the triple border area where its borders converge with those of Paraguay and Argentina. It is an area widely known for arms and drug smuggling, document and currency fraud, money laundering, and any number of other illegal activities. Estimates report $10 to $12 billion pass through the tri-border area annually. some of the money is diverted to Islamic militants in the Middle East. Brazil denies the presence of Islamic jihadists in the Triple Border area. In September 2007, President Lula da Silva launched a one-year, cabinet-level effort to develop a new security and national defense strategy. The ostensible goal is to make Brazil a military power in the 21st century. "We can't be subordinate," Lula said. "We have to be bold." Venezuela. President Hugo Chavez controls the world's fifth-largest oil-producing country, which places an enormous amount of money at his disposal. A Marxist protege of Fidel Castro, he proved to be an effusive firebrand that attracted a bevy of best friends in Russia, China, and Iran. President Chavez has shaped his government to serve as a model for the practical application of the Gramsci formula in Latin America and the Caribbean, and has given Colombia's narco-trafficking Marxist guerrillas, the FARC, privileged sanctuary in Venezuela. Many poor Latinos respect him highly for the programs he put into place to help those at the bottom of the economic ladder. Journalist Arno de Borchgrave calls Chavez a Robin Hood in Che Guevara clothing, robbing from the rich to give to the poor, including free hospitals staffed by 17,000 Cuban doctors and dentists. Despite Venezuela's billions of dollars in oil revenue, Hugo Chavez's socialism has brought high inflation, chronic food shortages and riots, growing crime, and long lines filled with hundreds of Venezuelans waiting to buy scarce supplies of milk, chicken, and sugar at state-run outdoor markets staffed by the military. Support for Chavez's Bolivarian socialism began to slip, even among the poorest of the poor. President Chavez remains fixated on his vision of emulating Simon Bolivar, a Caracas-born leader of rebel armies that freed a large area from Spanish rule in the early 19th century. Bolivar died in 1830. According to Chavez, Bolivar, like himself, was a socialist whose vision of a united Latin American was based on his determination to oppose the United States and building a classless society in opposition to an array of oligarchs and imperialists. Chavez is surrounded by extreme poverty in his own country, including sizable slums on the margins of Caracas. In 2007, 74% of Venezuelans were living under the poverty line. Chavez moved quickly following his election to the presidency, expropriating land and turning it over to small farmers and began nationalizing major industries. "I represent a nation," Chavez declared in 2003. The revolutionary hurricane has been unleashed in Venezuela and will not stop until we have a true and beautiful homeland. President Chavez ordered the creation of 17,000 communal councils across the country and assigned $2 billion to fund their operation. The official slogan of these councils is "Build Power from Below." The purpose is said to build grassroots democracy and give power to the people, but the real purpose seems to be strengthening central control. Urban poor were singled out for special attention, those most fervent supporters of Hugo Chavez. The members of these social councils also constitute the core of the nationwide militia being developed. The central core of these militias are trained in Cuban-style guerrilla warfare and counterinsurgency and armed with guns, grenades, and knives to defend Venezuela. These communal councils fall under Chavez's direct control. Plans are to expand Venezuela's reserve from about 200,000 to 1 million. In addition to building a controllable martial spirit in the Venezuelan people, the militias are focused away from their own hardships toward the gringos in the United States. Chavez's quest to end poverty in Venezuela led him to bring thousands of Cuban medics and education advisors into the country, as well as the Cuban secret police. Among the lessons Chavez learned from Castro was how best to tighten control over domestic politics through control of public institutions and enhancing his international stature by challenging the United States. Chavez, following Fidel Castro's advice, took a hard line in consolidating his position, especially after surviving a misfired military coup against him in April 2002. Two of the top plotters, the heads of Venezuela's largest business and labor federations, were hunted down by police and charged with treason. Chavez did not miss a step in the conduct of his revolutionary hurricane. In the summer 2007, Chavez, boasting the region's most powerful military, replaced his defense minister, General Raúl Bajual, with General Gustavo Rangel, who had commanded Venezuela's 100,000-member national militia. This was an important move, since it eliminated General Bajual, who said in his farewell speech that "we must separate ourselves from Marxist orthodoxy and strengthen the integration of the armed forces and the militias. Each would keep an eye on the other. By 2005, he moved to restrict freedom of the press, or as President Chavez put it, "We can say that the Venezuelan people have begun to free themselves from the dictatorship of the private media." Chavez engineered a law giving him the power to suspend the licenses of radio and television stations when their broadcasts were deemed to be contrary to the security of the nation. He also sent thousands of young Venezuelans to Cuba for indoctrination and rewrote the constitution to broaden his powers in several areas. For the Chavistas, any criticism of the president is an attack on the nation. President Chavez proclaimed that he could take away the concession of any media outlet that practices media terrorism. Major storm clouds hung over press freedoms in Venezuela after the Chavez government refused to renew the broadcast license of Radio Caracas Television, known simply as RCTV, in mid-2007. Since much of its wildly popular, racy soap operas drew a large audience, the Chavez government cited children as being affected by the sex and violence as being the reason for refusing to renew RCTV's license. Chavez had accused RCTV of poisoning the souls of children with irresponsible sex. But RCTV's programming also included daily reports that harshly criticized Chavez and the government, which in Chavez's terms made them media terrorists. Tens of thousands gathered in the streets of Caracas to protest the closure of the RCTV network. University students blocked a major highway for hours after the Radio Caracas Television ceased broadcasting. President Chavez would not budge, accusing RCTV of subversive activities. Rubber bullets and tear gas were fired by police in efforts to break up the demonstrations. The protesters chanted "freedom, freedom" to protest Hugo Chavez's refusal to renew RCTV's broadcast license. In the end, President Chavez won the day by silencing RCTV, one of the last sources of criticism of his increasingly totalitarian socialist, Marxist regime. Chavez and his guidance counselor Fidel Castro fulfilled the requirement in Gramsci's formula that requires shutting down independent media voices. Such an action is a prerequisite for success in the follow-up steps in the Gramscian blueprint for cultural revolution. Meanwhile, Bolivia and Ecuador took copycat initiatives to subdue the independent media. Bolivia's Evo Morales explained that the main adversaries of my presidency, of my government, are certain communications media. President Chavez's rush toward building socialism in Venezuela was slowed by the people's refusal to validate his 33 major constitutional changes proposed in August 2007 that would have allowed him to be re-elected indefinitely and to move forward on his Bolivarian revolution. With President Chavez's political supporters in firm control of the National Assembly, 160 supported the proposed constitutional revisions and 7 abstained. Thousands of events were scheduled to explain the 69 amendments requiring popular vote in order to secure approval through a referendum in December. University students began protests against the constitutional changes and were met by police firing tear gas and rubber bullets and other Chavez supporter firing pistols into the mass demonstrators. The confrontation led to the government challenging the autonomy of Venezuela's public universities, whose rectors were aligned with those opposing Hugo Chavez and his moves towards socialism. On December 1, 2007, Venezuelans rejected President Chavez's proposed amendments to the Constitution by a margin of nearly 10%. Many simply said they were opposed to socialism in Venezuela. Others believed the changes would have given Chavez too much power. Many dissatisfied Chavistas did not come out to vote. Among their grievances was Chavez's earlier insistence that the four political parties making up his governing coalition merge into a single United Socialist Party. Another smoldering anger center was based on Chavez's earlier heavy-handed refusal to renew the broadcasting license of a popular television station. Some in the military dragged their feet because of Chavez's effort to turn the military into a tool of his socialist project. And many Chavista politicians were unenthusiastic about the reforms, especially since their approval would allow Chavez to run for office indefinitely while other posts would still be functioning under the pre-socialist constitutional rules. President Chavez took his electoral defeat gingerly by saying that the motor seized up, so we'll have to go by donkey instead. He admitted that he had moved too fast and too far ahead of the Venezuelan people. Chavez said that his 5 years remaining on his current term in office would be focused on the 3 R's: the revision, rectification, and relaunching of the socialist revolution. From this platform, Chavez moved forward to address the outstanding issues and problems that led to the withholding of support for the proposed constitutional amendments in December 2007. By 2007, freedom of the press in Venezuela was in jeopardy as the country was moved another step toward 21st century socialism. Many journalists and media owners believe Chavez will control or eliminate all independent media voices by 2012. In the Gramsci blueprint, the Roman Catholic Church was public enemy number one. For the success of Marxism, the church must be destroyed. Hence, it was not surprising when Chavez took aim at the Roman Catholic Church, calling it a tumor on Venezuelan society. Chavez also told Archbishop Roberto Luckart Leon that he would see him in hell. After his 2006 re-election, Chavez faced a problem that Antonio Gramsci had warned about in achieving an indirect route to a Marxist government, the autonomy of the Roman Catholic Church, which served as a major source of contrary values to guide ordinary citizens in their daily lives. 96% of the Venezuelans were Roman Catholic in 2006, and 74% had expressed their trust in the church in a 2005 public opinion poll. The church stayed mostly to its ministries and serving the Venezuelan people. Cardinal Eurosa Savino, however, placed President Chavez on notice that the Venezuelan church would continue to speak against the slide towards socialist dictatorship, since it challenges liberty under the guise of helping the poor. The church in Latin America should maintain a clear separation between itself and the state, Father Robert A. Sirico counsels, but it also has an interest in preserving freedom and pluralism. President Chavez's response was interesting because it reflected Gramsci's teaching, and it became a key point in the Venezuelan model of the practicality of the Gramsci formula. Avoiding confrontation with Cardinal Savino, Chavez turned to self-immersion in Christian imagery. He used messianism as a means of trying to convince the Venezuelan people that socialism is Christianity and referred to the Christ as the greatest socialist in history. Chavez said that the kingdom of Christ is the kingdom of socialism. The church, however, was having none of it. Many church documents condemned socialism in theory and in practice. Taking measure of how Chavez deals with the Roman Catholic Church will be a central aspect of the Gramscian model exported to other Latin American countries. Marxists like Chavez must neutralize the church's influence, for Christian values by their very existence challenge dictatorial rule. Gramsci was clear. The Roman Catholic Church must be destroyed. The first casualty resulting from the quashing of religious freedom has always been individual liberty. Gramsci counseled that any formation of a national popular collective will is impossible unless the great mass of peasant farmers burst simultaneously into political life. Following the Italian thinker's formula, Hugo Chavez promised an agrarian revolution when he came to power in 1998. As elsewhere in Latin America, most of the country's agricultural lands were concentrated in a few hands. Chavez was especially harsh with cattlemen and owners of large estates, which made him very popular with Venezuela's numerous poor who made up the base of his political support. The elite were outraged, especially after the Chavez government handed out titles to about 9,000 acres to poor farmers in 2001. One cowman who lost 360 acres of his family's 7,400 acre ranch said, "I believe it is the beginning of the Cubanization of Venezuela." President Chavez's vision of a passive revolution by redistributing large land holdings picked up speed in 2005. Venezuela's poor were ecstatic as more titles to land were given to the rural farmers. Hailing Hugo Chavez, Carlos Julio Roja, who was awarded 37 acres, said that he, Chavez, is a man of the poor, the only one who has fought for the poor. He asked, how many peasants would be able to eat off this land? The landholding loser in this case was a British-owned 32,000-acre tract that had been expropriated by the government. By 2007, Chavez, after winning a third term in a landslide election in 2006, revved his proletarian engines, "We're heading towards socialism, and nothing and no one can prevent it." He requested the National Assembly to grant him special powers, a revolutionary enabling law that would permit him to approve economic laws by decree. Railing about the privatization that had preceded his presidency, Chavez spoke of the need to bring the country's most important oil fields under state control. Pocketing his new economic powers, Chavez quickly nationalized by decree Venezuela's electrical and telecommunications companies. The firms initially affected were the AES Corporation and CIE Nacional Telefonos de Venezuela, CNTV, the country's largest publicly traded company. The nation should recover its ownership of strategic sectors, Chavez declared. President Chavez spent billions of dollars to create the idea of Bolivarian Revolution across Latin America and the Caribbean. In August 2007, Chavez urged the Caribbean nations to seek greater independence from the United States. Pledging to share Venezuela's oil wealth, Chavez promised to provide fuel supplies under preferential conditions. Insinuating himself into the affairs in other countries, he created a backlash of varying intensity from country by country against his meddling. Yet, the score sheet includes several countries sliding leftward, with a few becoming ideological allies of Hugo Chavez. The fact that he has billions of dollars at his fingertips doubtlessly has not been lost in some of these strategic reorientations. Socialists of varying solidarities with Chavez ruled over 300 million people in early 2008. Venezuela, Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, Chile, Bolivia, Ecuador, and Nicaragua. Chavez had been helpful to some of the candidates. In July 2003, for instance, Chavez purchased as much as $3 billion in Argentine bonds, allowing the new socialist leader in Buenos Aires to pay off and cut ties with the neoliberal International Monetary Fund. Chavez also bought $25 million of Ecuador's debt and offered to buy $25 million more. In addition, Peru and Mexico in their respective 2006 national elections reflected sizable numbers of socialists voting, just missing defeat of conservative candidates. By 2006, Chavez was arming his soldiers with Russian weapons, having signed $3.5 billion worth of contracts with the Kremlin for more than 30 military fighter jets, 53 assault helicopters, and 100,000 AK-47 assault rifles. The United States delivered a formal protest to Russia over the sale of assault rifles, since Chavez was known to be working secretly with Marxist revolutionary guerrillas in the region. In mid-2007, Venezuela explored the possible purchase of 9 diesel-powered submarines from Russia at a cost of $3 billion. The 636 and 677E Amur-class submarines carry medium-range missiles. Russia asserted that it operated within the framework of international rules for arms exports and contended that the cooperation between Russia and Venezuela isn't aimed against anyone. China agreed to invest $100 billion in Latin America in a wide range of energy-related and commodity partnerships. The idea was to try to lessen Latin America's trade dependence on the U.S. China's aggressive policy in Latin America bore fruit by cutting trade deals with Cuba, Argentina, Brazil, and Venezuela. From 1997 to 2005, China invested $700 million in Venezuela, and trade between the two countries amounted to $3 billion in 2005. Beijing also invested $3 billion in Venezuela's petrochemical sector. Trade agreements between China and Venezuela include energy, agriculture, transportation, mining, housing, tourism, telecommunications, and information technology. President Chavez called it a new strategic alliance that was designed to foster multilateralism. President Chavez was warmly welcomed by President Hu Jintao in an August 2006 trip to China. Chavez expressed the hope that Venezuela could export 500,000 barrels of oil per day by 2009 and 1 million barrels a day in the coming decade. President Chavez also mentioned his willingness to buy jet fighters from China to supplement those he bought from Russia. In September 2006, China delivered the first of 3 advanced long-range air defense radars purchased by Venezuela. 7 more of the JYL-1 radars were in the pipeline. Visiting Iran for talks with President Mohammad Khatami in 2001, Chavez called for a strategic alliance to work for peace and stability. Both countries were members of OPEC and had been advocating higher oil prices. 5 years later, Hugo Chavez was riding high on a wave of soaring gas prices, and he teamed up with Russia, Iran, and China as a major oil consumer in an axis of oil. The new oil club challenged U.S. foreign policies as the Axis members pushed for an end to the unipolar world led by the United States to a multipolar international system in which Russia would have a strong voice. Another key aspect of Hugo Chavez's anti-U.S. program includes building close relationships with al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Seeing himself as the new Castro, a longtime collaborator with international terrorists, Chavez, according to a Venezuelan defector, rewarded al-Qaeda with $900,000 in cash and $100,000 in humanitarian aid to the Taliban after September 11th. He continued to follow his Cuban mentor's steps by collaborating with and assisting anti-U.S. international terrorists. Hugo Chavez is widely known to be sympathetic with the Marxist rebels, the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia Ejército del Pueblo, Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, People's Army, or FARC-EP. When one of the FARC's leaders was snatched by bounty hunters in Caracas while attending a leftist conference, Chavez was outraged at the violation of Venezuela's sovereignty. When Colombian military force began bombarding a FARC camp just inside a remote area of Ecuador at the end of February 2008, killing 21 guerrillas, including one of its top commanders, Paul Reyes, Chavez treated this as a cause for war. He ordered troops to the border with Colombia, broke of diplomatic relations with Bogota, and warned Colombia's President Alvaro Uribe not to try such an action against Venezuela. Meanwhile, Ecuador's President Rafael Correa, a socialist confidant of Chavez's, felt compelled to follow suit by dispatching troops to the border with Venezuela. Little more than torrents of insults were exchanged by the three leaders, but the military confrontation was the first in South America for more than a decade. After a week-long intervention of the Organization of American States, the crisis was calmed by a softly nuanced compromise. The greatest danger exposed in this scrap with Colombia was President Chavez's hair-trigger response to a quite minor Colombian cross-border operation. Chavez showed extraordinary immaturity. He bears watching. According to one report, Chavez is following the blueprint Fidel Castro drafted for Chile's Salvador Allende, who imported thousands of Cuban paramilitaries to overthrow the constitution in Chile in order to establish a communist regime. Chavez is continually facing domestic unrest and challenges to the revolutionary road of Antonio Gramsci. In an effort to ensure that his passive revolution takes place, Chavez is replicating parts of Cuba's experience by plugging international terrorist networks into the country's security services, financial system, and state corporations as part of his plans. Islamic terrorists have been operating out of Venezuela's resort island of Margarita, located about 23 miles off the northeast coast of Venezuela. The island serves as a stop-off for terrorists en route to the tri-border region or triple frontier, a no-man's land where the borders of Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay converge. Margarita has been identified as a center of terrorist financing along with the Cayman Islands and Panama. Hezbollah was also suspected of using Margarita Island as a part of its financial network. Other socialist countries. Six countries with socialist governments, Bolivia, Ecuador, Uruguay, Nicaragua, Argentina, and Chile, are primary candidates to join the Chavez-led Bolivarian Revolution. Two additional countries are of interest because of the sizable proportion of their voters leaning toward the left, Peru and Mexico. And Colombia is of concern because of the sizable number of Marxist guerrillas engaged in a Leninist-style armed revolution through violence and terrorism. Bolivia. Following several years of violence and turmoil in Bolivia, a socialist understudy of Hugo Chavez was elected president in January 2006. Evo Morales, of Aymara Indian origin, was a Marxist deputy in the National Congress where he headed the leftist caucus. He was better known as head of the Cocoleros, about 30,000 coca-growing farmers and peasants in the Chapo region of the country. He blamed the United States for the poverty in Bolivia owing to the geopolitical and economic interests of multinational corporations. He declared, "Peasants resort to illegal crops as the only alternative to poverty." Strikes by workers and peasants were almost continuous in 2001, demanding an end to U.S.-sponsored drug eradication. One Marxist, Oscar Oliveira, was leader of riots in Cochabamba, where he led members of the Federation of Factory Workers against foreign control of water resources. He showed up in Washington, D.C., in April 2000 when the Institute for Policy Studies, the think tank of the left, presented him its Orlando Leetly Irani Moffat Award for his leadership in the union insurrection against privatization of public water supplies. Bolivia remained a political powder keg through 2001 with protests by miners and workers in other economic sectors. With three-quarters of Bolivia's people living below the poverty line, many analysts at the time referred to the country's pre-revolutionary condition. President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada held on until October 2003. Following 6 weeks of massive protests, he fled to Miami. By this time, Evo Morales was riding a crest of popularity while leading the movement towards socialism political party and serving as the head of the coca-growing union. I dream of boosting this anti-imperialist message with a great summit including Fidel, Lula, and Chavez, to show that we are united, and to make the North American imperialists think twice, Evo Morales declared. After chasing President Sanchez de Lozada out of the country, Bolivia's indigenous majority had, for the first time, found its political voice. 10% of the population owned 90% of Bolivia's wealth. Many of the indigenous Indian majority were homeless and lived on less than $2 a day. Dependent on outside assistance, South America's poorest country relied on the World Bank and International Monetary Fund. The government had traditionally served the white and mestizo minority, largely ignoring the majority indigenous Indian population. When Bolivia's hydrocarbons were assessed between 1997 and 2002, Bolivia's proven reserves of gas increased by 362% to an estimated 55 trillion cubic feet. A dream had come true. But Bolivia's civil society feared the government would favor foreign investors over the people. The water war in Cochabamba also had generated a combative mood in the country's social movements. The issue of who should profit from Bolivia's resources continued to hound new President Carlos Mesa. But continuing anti-government protests, violence, and the rage of the people drove him from office in June 2005. Mesa's departure was a victory for the cocaleros who had already profited by expanding their crops during the prolonged period of instability. The Morales-directed Movement to Socialism organized the final round of protests that toppled President Mesa. Evo Morales was elected president of Bolivia in December 2005, the country's first indigenous chief executive. At his first news conference, Morales explained that he believed the United States used the fight against drug trafficking as a false pretext to install military bases. Saying that his government would fight drugs, Morales said that neither cocaine or drug trafficking are part of the Bolivian culture. Comfortable in the warm embrace of Venezuela's Hugo Chavez and Cuba's Fidel Castro, President Morales moved quickly down a socialist path laid out by the Gramsci-Chavez model. First, Morales promised to emulate Hugo Chavez. Morales declared, "I guarantee you the presence of Comrade Chavez, who will teach us how he brought forward a new constitution in Venezuela and fought with the gringos and oligarchy." A national assembly set up in August 2006 had 1 year to write a new constitution that would deliver a second liberation to the Bolivian people. Shortly after his inauguration, Evo Morales confronted the country's Roman Catholic bishops over the teaching of religion in the schools. Many were surprised by his action since the church had a close relationship with the grassroots groups that brought him to power. But the Roman Catholic Church remained Antonio Gramsci's enemy number one. Morales apparently found that the time was not right to challenge the church directly and backed off the idea of confronting the country's bishops. But his time would come. In January 2006, Morales moved to tighten his control of the security services by expelling 28 generals from the police and armed forces for alleged complicity with a U.S. planned covert operation to remove Bolivia's air defenses. The new president brought in Cuban and Venezuelan intelligence teams to clear government offices of hidden microphones. He sent about 10,000 of the Movement to Socialism party cadre to Cuba with medical scholarships for education and needed specializations. Morales announced plans to redistribute 77,000 square miles, an area about the size of Nebraska, among Bolivia's Indian majority from 2007 to 2011. The land that Morales promised to redistribute included acreage and private holdings deemed unproductive or fraudulently obtained. The government will also help the farmers by providing technical support, equipment, schools, and safe drinking water. Mr. Morales proposed legislation that would allow the government to tighten control of the media. The legislation was said to be necessary to take measures against television for content deemed to be harmful to society. Meanwhile, Venezuela provided $2 million to finance a new state-owned television channel and more than 100 provincial radio stations' propaganda transmitters throughout Bolivia. And President Morales was given $30 million to subsidize some of the country's municipalities. Six members of Spain's Basque ETA terrorist group traveled to Bolivia and met with high officials of the Morales government in 2006. They bought homes in Cochabamba, Bolivia's narco-trafficking center and stronghold of Evo Morales' movement towards socialism that was instrumental in bringing him to power. The Basque political organization Batasuna issued a communique praising the Morales government, calling Bolivia's movement towards socialism a model for the Basque region. Hugo Chavez promised to dispatch 400 accountants from Venezuela's state oil company to Bolivia to audit the books of foreign energy companies. Supposedly, the auditors searched for evidence to support renegotiation of existing contracts under the threat of expropriation. President Morales nationalized Bolivia's energy resources on May 1, 2006. Foreign firms operating at Bolivia's oil and natural gas fields were given a choice to either cede control of their operations or leave the country. Seven companies signed new contracts with the Bolivian government, the caretaker of the country's energy resources. In a demonstration for the Bolivian people, Morales sent soldiers to occupy fields that he said had plundered the country's energy riches for years. It was a wildly popular move for most Bolivians. The new deals compelled the foreign energy companies to give at least 50% of their revenue to the state energy company. The percentages surrendered could range as high as 82% of revenues for large producers. In a visit to China in February 2006, President Morales was counseled to avoid taking actions that could prompt the U.S. to organize a coup among disaffected military officers. "You have to be nice to the United States," he was told, reflecting China's own long-term strategy to undermine U.S. influence in Latin America. Playing nice is a key to Gramsci's formula for passive revolution. The Chinese offered Morales 38 Chinese-made HN 5-man-pad surface-to-air missiles to replace those taken by the CIA in a covert operation in December 2005. The agency had been helped by Bolivian security officers who feared the missiles would find their way into the hands of terrorists. The man-portable air defense missile is a shoulder-fired, low-altitude missile, which, in terrorist hands, could be used against commercial airliners. Morales celebrated his first year in office in January 2007 with nearly a 50% approval rating. The partial nationalization of the country's energy sector promised more revenue for Bolivia's socialist pathway. By drastically altering the tax structure, the Bolivian government received 82% of the profits generated by the foreign energy countries. This percentage was exactly the reverse of profit sharing before the renegotiation of the company's contracts. Next on Morales' nationalization agenda was overhauling the mining industry. Accusing the justice system of constraining the nationalization of key economic sectors in Bolivia's march towards socialism, Morales demanded the resignation of four Supreme Court justices. He accused the judicial system of stealing $300 million and releasing delinquents, thieves, and narco-traffickers. Mr. Morales was supported by key members of the movement towards socialism. Morales's success rate began to decline in late 2007 when the Indian coalition that brought him to power was split by rivalries. Strikes, riots, and threats occurred in six of Bolivia's nine provinces. The chief complaints were the drift toward dictatorship and militant socialism. Informal alliances were formed to protect people's democratic rights. While Morales and government soldiers were dealing with the uprisings, Hugo Chavez made it clear that he was not amused. He declared that he would wage war against Bolivia if the opposition tried to topple Morales. Then, perhaps with the ghost of Chile's Marxist president Salvador Allende, who was overthrown and killed on September 11, 1973, whispering in his ear, Hugo Chavez said, "I warn the oligarchy of Bolivia that if they overthrow or assassinate Evo, Venezuela will not remain with its arms crossed." Ecuador. Leftist Lucio Gutierrez won over Ecuador's poor and indigenous Indian workers and, from that political base, defeated banana magnate Alvaro Noboa for the presidency in November 2002. Noboa was the country's richest man, heading more than 110 companies. The country's leftist alignment was shown when an estimated 10,000 to 12,000 local and foreign protesters marched in Quito against 33 trade representatives from the Organization of American States who had arrived in Ecuador's capital to discuss the ramifications of the proposed free trade area of the Americas Agreement. The nationalities of Ecuador asserted that the proposed easing of trade restrictions would put an end to life, natural resources, national production, and employment. Shouting, Los excluidos por trabajo, justicia y vida, excluded ones for jobs, justice, and life, left-wing nationalities of Ecuador registered its opposition. President Gutierrez's missteps in governance led to allegations of corruption and charges of making backroom deals. The 100-seat unicameral Congress removed him from office, and Ecuador's military withdrew its support for Gutierrez. After the fumbles by an interim president for more than a year, the Ecuadorian electorate was overwhelmingly supportive of left-wing economist Rafael Correa for president in November 2006. With a doctorate in economics from the University of Illinois, President Correa spoke sharply against globalization, neoliberal and orthodox economic policies, and multilateral financial organizations, especially the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. A Roman Catholic, he embraced the People's Church idea of Latin American liberation theology. When opponents cast him as a Chavez clone, Correa responded sharply, "We are not copying Lula, Chavez, or Kirchner. We are not waiting for a prescription from abroad." President Correa won by making it clear that he was against market reforms, the Bush administration, a free trade agreement with the United States, and transnational corporations that did not obey the law. He also threatened to default in Ecuador's $10 billion foreign debt if social needs were greater than the imperative to service the debt. He promised the long-abused Ecuadorian people that the government would construct low-cost homes and double the $36 poverty bonus to 1.2 million poor Ecuadorians. Correa said that Ecuador would rejoin OPEC to assist in seeking the best price for the 555,000 barrels of oil it pumps per day. He said that he would seek closer ties with leftist presidents such as Michelle Bachelet in Chile, Nestor Kirchner in Argentina, and Luis Inácio Lula da Silva in Brazil. "Hugo Chavez is a friend of mine," he explained to his critics. Correa's doctoral thesis at the University of Illinois reflected a deep-seated concern with the distribution of income. His thesis dealt with the impact of globalization on development and poverty. President Correa said that, "We are looking for a united Latin America that can confront a globalization that is inhumane and cruel." A close ally of Hugo Chavez, Ecuador's president asserted in late 2007 that he thought his Venezuelan friend was a very honest person, a clear leader, a very democratic president. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad attended Rafael Correa's inauguration and said that any nation seeking to defend itself can count on Iranian aid. He added that we are partisans of peace. It is the Americans who are at war with the entire world. Uruguay. The leader of the neo-Marxist Broad Front, Tabar Ramon Vazquez Rosas, was sworn in as president on March 1, 2005. Thousands of supporters celebrated in the streets of Montevideo in support of Vazquez Rosas, who promised to work tirelessly for the people. Except for Fidel Castro, who had to cancel for health reasons, the Latin American Marxist gang were all there. Brazil's Lula da Silva, Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, Argentina's Nestor Kirchner, and Chile's Richard Lagos, plus Paraguay's centrist Nicanor Duarte Fritos. One of President Vazquez's first acts was restoration of diplomatic ties with Cuba. He also announced a $100 million emergency social welfare plan to provide basic health care and food for the country's neediest. The Gramsci formula had helped bring another leftist to power in Latin America. The Broad Front had entered the political scene in 1971, a loose coalition of communist and socialist parties, the Christian Democratic Party, and others attracted from small left-wing parties, including the then-urban guerrilla Marxist Tupamaros, whose loyalty was to Fidel Castro. Surviving an iron-fist response from Uruguay's government, the Broad Front's membership added and dropped various leftist groups over time. However, after the restoration of democracy, the Front steadily increased its membership. Voter support for the Front remained stable over the years, gaining strength since 2002 when austerity measures were put into place to service the country's foreign debt. Vazquez rode the crest of the misery wave right into the presidency. The Vasquez campaign promised to apply a new and more equitable development model, Graham sighed, one that will benefit the workers, the middle classes, the most vulnerable sectors of society, and sectors involved in the various areas of national production. He had plenty counsel from his Marxist compatriots in Latin America. Uruguayan parliamentary investigators discovered an attempt to smuggle 15,000 rounds of Iranian-made 5.56mm ammunition aboard one of its naval vessels. The shipment was picked up in Venezuela and was part of a larger deal involving the purchase of 18,000 Iranian-made automatic rifles. The deal would have violated the UN Security Council restrictions imposed on Iran for failing to halt its uranium enrichment program. The Iran-Venezuela-Uruguay triangulation appeared to be a part of the $2 billion strategic fund announced by Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and President Chavez in their September 2007 meeting in Caracas. The fund was to be used to help Latin American governments liberate themselves from imperialism. One, the Uruguayan Broad Front's coalition members, the Tupamaros Liberation Front, supports the Chavez brand of socialism. Nicaragua. The Sandinista National Liberation Front, FSLN, seized power from dictator Anastasio Somoza in 1979. The Sandinistas were a pro-Soviet, pro-Castro revolutionary group that pledged a broad, all-inclusive democracy. However, it was not long before the FSLN took the Nicaraguan people down a pathway toward a Soviet model of totalitarianism. The slaughter of indigenous Indians and the heavy footprint of Marxism-Leninism soon snuffed the flicker of the people's democratic aspirations and hope for an end to human rights abuses. The principal architect of the Sandinistas' brutal rule was Daniel Ortega. The Sandinistas stumbled, however, by believing their own propaganda in the 1980s that they had consolidated their rule and enjoyed widespread popular support. Hence, they consented to national elections in 1990. The surprise of surprises occurred when Violeta Chamorro of the Liberal Constitutional Party won 51% of the popular vote in the presidential elections, defeating the bloody rule of Daniel Ortega. Mr. Ortega ran for president three more times in the 1990s and 2000s, losing each time. Behind the scenes, however, the FSLN Sandinistas were busy working with terrorists from the Middle East, Europe, and Latin America, including such state sponsors as Iraq and Libya, and transnational groups like Colombia's FARC, the Basque ETA, and others. Five Nicaraguan passports were found in the apartments of suspected terrorists in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing in New York. Nicaragua's political system struggled through the 1990s with a long list of economic and corruption problems. The FSLN, which put its weapons down in 1992 and joined the political mainstream, did not lose its Marxist revolutionary edge. It was not lost on the Sandinistas that Nicaragua was a poor country with two-thirds of its population living in poverty. Confronted with these intractable realities, Nicaragua's democracy remained on a shaky life support system. Unable to deliver relief to the majority of people, the central government's position eroded over time while the Sandinistas' position improved. The Sandinistas were among the initial members of the Forum of Sao Paulo organized by Lula da Silva and Fidel Castro in 1990. The da Silva-Castro idea was to help radical political leaders win control of their countries through successful campaigns and national elections. Following the Gramsci blueprint, Marxists would present themselves as populists opposed to corruption in government and as being dedicated to helping the poor by providing health programs, education, and workable anti-poverty measures. The Sandinistas rebounded in 2004 by winning the mayoral office in Managua and several other municipalities. Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega described the election results as a new revolution without guns or bloodshed, which seems to be a direct reference to the passive revolution formula designed by Antonio Gramsci. The die was cast for Daniel Ortega's return, not as an ardent Marxist-Leninist, but as a man of the people, a follower of Marxist revisionist Antonio Gramsci. For instance, he joined forces with Arnaldo Alemán's Liberal Party, a Gramscian move, that would have ended the existing administration by gutting the powers of the presidency. It would seem that Ortega had learned his lessons well about the Gramsci formula for success at the schoolhouse of the Sao Paulo Forum. Gone during Nicaragua's 2006 presidential campaign was Ortega's fiery Marxist-Leninist rhetoric. His new message conformed with Gramsci's counsel to say or do whatever was necessary to achieve power through the electoral process. Only then should measures be taken to shape societal values in a way to support a consolidation of power sufficiently to impose Marxist principles on society and its political system. During his presidential campaign, Ortega gave everyone a peek into how he would rule in the initial days of his new presidency. The challenges he faced were great. Nicaragua's 5.5 million people were the second poorest in the Western Hemisphere. Only Haiti ranked lower. Annual per capita income was about $910. Ortega's answer was to partner with Fidel Castro, Lula da Silva, Hugo Chavez, and other socialist leaders in rejecting what he called savage capitalism. "We are victims of a savage neoliberalism," a street vendor supporter of Ortega said. "But united, we will keep fighting this neoliberal system that lets our children die of hunger." The street vendor spilled the beans about Ortega's true position, while Ortega began his tenure as president of Nicaragua with an engaging smile. He emphasized peace, reconciliation, stability, close ties with the United States, and free trade. He also presented socialist images of free education, medical care, wage supplements to the poor, and land redistribution. In actuality, Ortega basked in the warm welcome to the world of Gramsci from Lula da Silva, Fidel Castro, and Hugo Chavez. Subsidized oil and gas deliveries from Venezuela would help the new regime consolidate its power. And Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's visit in January 2007 promised additional assistance to help Daniel Ortega consolidate his position before the next revolutionary steps were taken. Argentina. Argentine President Néstor Kirchner burst onto the political scene in May 2003 and combined an assault on entrenched domestic interests with an aggressive foreign policy. Signaling his socialist, if not Marxist, propensities, Kirchner quickly established warm relations with Fidel Castro, Luis Inácio Lula da Silva, and Hugo Chavez. The trio representing Latin America's leftist brain trust and primary funder. Kirchner also reached out to other leaders estranged from the United States, including Bolivia's Evo Morales. In a January 2004 meeting of the Special Summit of the Americas, Kirchner boasted that he would win by a knockout in an upcoming meeting scheduled with President George W. Bush. Kirchner successfully restructured $120 billion in total debt of the $190 billion Argentina owed, which included past interest due that covered 150 bond issues and 600,000 investors. As a result of these moves, Argentina's total debt fell from $190 billion to $125 billion in 1 month without assistance from the International Monetary Fund. This step forward gave Argentina a small space for tackling other debt issues, serving as a drag on the country's economy. While President Bush met with 33 presidents attending the November 2005 Summit of the Americas, thousands of protesters rallied against the United States and capitalism. One protester from Honduras put the demonstrations very simply: "We're a people united against free trade, because free trade is a policy of death for our countries." In October 2007, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, Argentina's first lady, won the presidency with more than 40% of the votes. She replaced her husband, Néstor, in December and became Argentina's first woman elected president. Her popularity was based largely on her husband's success in pulling the country back from the threshold of economic collapse since 2001. President Fernandez de Kirchner is a street-smart lawyer who worked ably by her husband's side. While political continuity is assured to some degree in the Fernandez de Kirchner presidency, a number of dicey economic issues continue to plague the country, including high inflation, price controls, and surging energy demand. One merchant is quoted as exclaiming, "I'm so excited. Cristina is going to pull us out of poverty." Chile. The country's first chief executive, Michelle Bachelet, was sworn into office on March 11, 2006. President Bachelet became the fourth consecutive leader of the socialist coalition that had ruled Chile since 1990. While a socialist, Ms. Bachelet sits at the pragmatic end of the leftist ruling in Latin America. The region's socialist Marxist ruling elite were on their best behavior at Bachelet's swearing-in ceremony, including Kirchner, Vasquez, Lula da Silva, and Morales. one can be certain that their collective most ardent desire was to guide President Bachelet onto the path of following the Gramsci formula in Chile and to oppose free trade, or what they call U.S. imperialism. Time will tell if Bachelet takes the bait. Venezuela's Hugo Chavez could not help himself from saying, "In Latin America, you have a laborer becoming president, that's Lula, an Indian, Evo, has arrived, a socialist woman, and a soldier, that's me, a revolutionary soldier, building a new South American project that is vital for the salvation of our people, Bolivarian Revolution." The combined effect of the Forum of Sao Paulo setting the stage for implementation of Antonio Gramsci's Cultural Blueprint for Action and Hugo Chavez's Bolivarian Revolution has set several Latin American countries on a pathway towards socialism-Marxism. President Chavez provided the model for others to follow and the inspiration of Simon Bolivar as a liberator in class warfare. Hugo Chavez was overwhelmingly elected to office in 1998 by the 80% of Venezuelans who were mired in poverty and with little hope for their world to change. By winning the popular elections, Chavez changed the rules of society against the wealthy elite businessmen, holders of large tracts of land, the armed forces and mass media, and others enjoying privileged positions. President Chavez continued to restructure society as he moved toward creation of a model socialist state built on the cooperation of masses. His paradigm underwriting the Bolivarian Revolution was designed for export through emulation, first by Bolivia and Ecuador, Uruguay and Argentina, Nicaragua, and, perhaps in the future, Chile. The efforts by Fidel Castro and Lula da Silva in the 1990s to slow roll the United States toward limiting free trade helped to provide a formula for the successes already won by the Forum of Sao Paulo, South America's Gramscian version of socialism.